Thank you, John.
Well, the rest of you come down here, there's seats down here. There's some seats down here, sir.
Here's one right here.
Damn right, I'm an old timer here.
Right there, sir. Sit right by me. Right there. Right there by me.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be at this conference organized by the Brookings Institution, and especially to participate in this third seminar on the important and very complex subject of the quality of the environment. This is a subject that, as you all know, has received a tremendous amount of national and international attention in recent years, and one that's destined, in my viewpoint and in many other people's viewpoint, to become of even greater concern to all citizens in the years ahead, as we begin especially to recognize that man's tremendous technological prowess has negative as well as positive implications for his future on this earth. The specific subject that John assigned to me, as you know, is a policy of development vis-a-vis a policy of conservation, a land use policy for the future Alaska. But what I wish to do tonight is to look at the broader connotations of this subject so that the specific problems and issues facing Alaska today can be visualized in a knowledgeable perspective. I hope this will serve not only as an introduction to the other speakers at this seminar, but will also make my own specific remarks and suggestions tomorrow and in the other sessions on environmental policy more understandable. First of all, I think that we must take a look at two culprits that have grossly confused the real issue. These are the words development and conservation, whose popular connotations tend to force an artificial polarization of people's thinking into one or the other of these extremes. This is the central point of my book on Alaska land policy, which I understand John sent out to most everybody. And as I pointed out there, in a chapter entitled Development versus Conservation, Alaska seems to have attracted a number of people who are fit in both of these categories. We have the people who are the epitome of the extreme 20th century developers. They see Alaska merely as a northern extension of the western frontier, and they wish to populate and industrialize this country as rapidly as possible. They envy California, her crowded millions, and want to create Alaska and Alaska cities like Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, what George Rogers called at one time the Fifth Avenue on the Tundra syndrome. They see themselves as modern pioneers, and they demand the freedom of action that was given their counterparts a century ago. And to them, any land use is a good use, as long as you can get it into some use. But as I tried to point out in the book, that this those who take this extreme view don't seem to realize that in their zeal, they may be sacrificing those unique natural values, which in the long run are the only real values upon which Alaska can build a healthy, productive, and enjoyable society in which to live. In short, as I pointed out there, that they would have us make mud pies out of gold dust. On the other hand, at the other extreme, are the immoderate preservationists who come to Alaska for the most part to get away from the rushing industrial environment that the developers wish to create, and they believe economic development has gone much too far already, and they are quick to attack any proposals for further development. They would prefer an Alaska as wild and as unsettled as it was when the United States took it over from Russia. And in this effort, they have the powerful support of various national preservation groups who see the natural environment rapidly eroding everywhere under the guise of economic development. But with this group, just as with the other, by following such a narrow philosophy, they may be defeating their own purpose too. For a state that is in the throes of economic bankruptcy, which Alaska was and has been in the past, is in no position to countenance wise policies of land and resource management. This costs money. In short, if the preservationists press too hard toward their narrow objectives, they may be killing the goose that lays the golden egg. Well, battles between these two extreme forces are becoming more frequent and strident, with the result that crucial policy decisions are based less and less on any rational process of decision making and more on the balance of political forces on any specific issue. A great deal of heat is generated, but little light to guide the way. And we get sort of a to and fro policy drift, which sets in, that's not only costly, but time consuming and frustrating, and in the long run is satisfying to absolutely no one. Somehow this polarization of views must be overcome if we are to move toward more constructive policies that will meet the needs of the people in the last third of the 20th century. Fortunately, there is, I think, another avenue that offers an opportunity to blend these apparently dichotomous views, though it is only now beginning to take concrete shape. For want of a better term, I will refer to it as environmental management. It's based on the recognition that society's problems have changed greatly in the last several decades, and that our existing economic and political institutions have not adjusted accordingly. As a result, we all too frequently are focusing on the wrong issues. Many of you, I know, are fully cognizant of what I'm talking about, but let me try to state the situation as I see it, as clearly and as succinctly as possible. First, I think we must begin with the recognition that the economic system in this country has been extremely successful. We are, as everyone knows, the most affluent nation in the world, and our material well-being is beyond compare in terms not only of the basic necessities of life, but also in terms of material luxuries and the leisure time in which to enjoy them. We still have, as you all know, severe pockets of poverty throughout the country. But these are primarily sociological or ethical problems that can't be solved merely by increasing the rate of economic growth. They must be tackled differently. We have moved from a situation in this country in which general poverty has given way to general affluence, yet we still cling tenaciously to this idea of more and faster economic growth as the as the principal solution to nearly all of our problems. In the past, of course, when we were in most of us in a poverty situation, it made a lot of sense. But in an era of affluence, it creates some problems to continue to follow that as a single purpose goal. Second, I think we are beginning to recognize also as a nation that our economic system, while so successful in that sense that I just talked about, also produces some serious side effects that are now coming home to roost and to plague us. That the system which has produced much that is good in our modern society is also bringing unanticipated consequences in the form of noise, pollution of rivers, smog, atomic radiation, filthy streets, littered highways, junkyards full of rusty automobile bodies, loss of recreational opportunities, landscapes scarred by freeways and open pit mines, urban and rural blight, deterioration of fish and wildlife resources, and on, a myriad other affronts to the quality of life in this country. In an earlier era, these so-called side effects, these externalities as the economists call them, the spin-off things from the operation of our economic system, could be shrugged off as minor defects in the operation of the market system. But today, in this highly urbanized, industrialized, and interconnected society, their cumulative impact becomes almost unbearable despite high and continuously increasing material affluence. Third, we are beginning to realize that these side effects may have broader and more far-reaching implications than anyone ever thought. Man-made pollution is bad enough in itself, but it reflects something even worse, a dangerous illusion that technological man can build bigger and better industrial societies with little regard for the human environment. But modern means of travel and communication have reduced the world almost to a neighborhood, which makes imperative a much clearer understanding of the nature and significance of man's long-term impact on the biosphere, on the atmosphere, on the hydrosphere, and on the lithosphere on a global basis. Recent studies indicate, for example, that nuclear fallout may have played a significant role in increasing infant mortality rates all over the globe. The SST, as you know, threatens to crisscross the Earth with carpets of sonic boom, affecting hundreds of millions of people every day, several times a day. And incidentally, the Arctic route, from the maps I've seen, will likely be one of the most intensively used. There is the increasing carbon dioxide content of the upper atmosphere, which results from the burning of fossil fuels, and this, as I'm sure many of you know, has begun to alarm scientists because of the potential greenhouse effect, as they call it, that it may have in increasing the temperature of the Earth's surface. The DDT has been found to occur even in the penguins in the Antarctic and now in the polar bear in the Arctic. As Dr. Barry Commoner has pointed out in his book, Science and Survival, like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, we are acting on dangerously incomplete knowledge. We are, in effect, he said, conducting a huge experiment on ourselves. that this problem does not respect ideological or political boundaries is attested to by the recent remarks of the eminent Soviet physicist Dr. Andrei Sakharov, who writes of the senseless despoilation of the Soviet Union caused by bureaucratic and egotistical interests, and sometimes simply by questions of bureaucratic prestige. And he concludes with these words, the problem of geo-hygiene, as they call it in the Soviet Union, earth hygiene, if you will, is highly complex and closely tied to economic and social problems. This problem cannot, therefore, be solved on a national or local basis. Our salvation, he says, requires that we overcome our ideological divisions and the pressures of temporary local interests. Otherwise, the Soviet Union will poison the United States with its wastes and vice versa. My fourth point here is that these changing conditions force all of us to redefine our goals and objectives no matter where we live and to seek new approaches to these pressing problems. In a nutshell, it is demanding that we take an entirely different look at man's relationship to the total environment. An environment that's not only a storehouse of basic raw materials, a great supermarket of, as some see it, a great supermarket of wealth to be drawn upon at will to improve our material standard of living, but also an environment which is our only abode in a shrinking world, the place where we live, raise our families, and whose condition strongly influences our mental and moral well-being as well as our aesthetic senses. This does not mean, of course, that economic goals cease to be important, but that they must be viewed and understood in an altogether different context. The same may be said of the narrow objectives of preservationists. It is useless to try to save a beautiful wilderness area only to be enshrouded in a continuous smog. And it is here that one begins to see the real possibilities for a genuine blending of these heretofore dichotomous viewpoints. The melding of economics and ecology, if you will, in a new approach to public policy based on a much fuller understanding of the whole man and his intricate interrelationships with his environment. This shift in thinking from economic man to the whole man is not going to come easily, because our thought patterns have been programmed over time to think in these terms. And most of our political and social institutions are geared to an earlier era when life was much simpler. These things, such as social institutions, of course, don't change easily, but there are some healthy signs. As the evidence of environmental deterioration has compounded in the last decade, complacency has become the hallmark of only those few who cannot comprehend the obvious. This is reflected in the tremendous outpouring of books, magazines, and newspaper articles, television specials, and other pronouncements through the mass media raising this question of why ugliness, disorder, and an unhealthy environment must necessarily be the price of progress. And no less significantly, natural scientists, economists, political scientists, lawyers, psychologists, geographers, urban planners, and other scholars and professionals have begun in earnest, really for the first time, to dig into the fundamental problems of man's critical relation to his environment. And this has resulted in a great outpouring of scholarly publications, almost as great in volume as the popular literature on this subject. There has also been an awakening in the political sphere, which has resulted in the United States Congress considering and passing a record volume of environmental legislation in the 1960s, as well as other more recent efforts at the federal level and in a few state legislatures to reorganize the executive branch of government so that it can deal more forcefully with these problems. This is a subject I want to talk about in more detail tomorrow, but it is certainly worth mentioning here as an indication of the shift in thinking now occurring in this country. This shift is also evident to anyone who has been among students on a university campus recently, for the issues of environmental quality are becoming potentially as explosive as Vietnam and civil rights, and it is predicted by some to become the overriding political and social issue among students in the decade of the 70s. I brought with me a recent article out of the Christian Science Monitor by Robert Kahn. Some of you probably saw it, entitled Youth Takes Over at National Environmental Conference. And I would just like to quote a little bit here. If the activities at the annual conference of the United States National Commission for UNESCO are an indicator of the environmental revolution now taking place, youth power is about to wrest the leadership away from the establishment. And the more than 500 civic leaders, public officials, scientists, and environmentalists at the conference appeared to welcome the revolt. From all sections of the nation, participants arrived here to take part in a three-day meeting on man and his environment, a view toward survival. It was billed as an action conference, but until the youth takeover on the final day, the meeting produced little action and much talk about such problems as pollution, overpopulation, and other threats to the environment. The student takeover, incidentally, was in no way a violent sort of thing. They were well organized and merely organized their own sessions and presented position papers and drew up their own policy statements. I think it's interesting, a little sidelight on this too, is that one of the participants at this national conference was Robert O. Anderson, whom I'm sure many of you know, who's with the board, is board chairman of Atlantic Richfield Company. And Mr. Anderson had this to say: I would not be surprised, and I would not be entirely unsympathetic, if some of the activist elements which now find their focus in opposition to the war in Vietnam found their next focus against projects and proposals that despoil the environment. The industrialist said that the present restlessness among our youth is a rejection of what they see as unmitigated materialism. He added that the positive side is the search for new and more rewarding qualitative values which should appeal to their constructive energies. I think it's very clear that the young generation abhors the environmental mess they see all around them, and they also seem bent upon doing something about it. It's imperative that the Alaska situation be viewed in this broader national perspective, and this is why I've taken the time to outline some of these points in detail. In effect, Alaska has made a quantum jump into the last third of the 20th century. For decades, it was hamstrung by severe political and economic constraints. And then in the late 1950s, the people of Alaska succeeded not only in gaining statehood, and hence a much larger degree of political control over their destiny, and I was proud to be some part of that, but they also adopted a modern constitution and developed a well-organized and highly efficient governmental organization that is the envy of many of the, and if not most of the states in the Union. This is not to say that your governmental structure is faultless, but that the basic political concepts employed when it was established make it possible for you and for public officials at least to act quickly and vigorously if they so desire, which cannot be said at all of most antiquated state governments. Despite this progressive approach to governmental organization, however, the new state of Alaska found itself faced with serious economic and financial problems. This, as I mentioned, and as all of you know, brought the state government almost to the brink of bankruptcy a couple of times and forced it at most times to approach the challenge, opportunities, and responsibilities of statehood in a very parsimonious fashion. As a result, the state has tended to emphasize economic development and financial returns to the state treasury in nearly all of its land and resource programs. This was to be deplored, but fully understood by those who followed closely the ups and downs of the state financial situation during the last 10 years. The main point to be made here, however, is that in this year, 1969, Alaska moved overnight from one of the poorest to one of the richest states in the nation, at least in per capita terms, and I guess there's several other ways you could measure it. As one economist recently pointed out, the state of Alaska is now earning $7,800 every hour, or $187,500 every day, just in the interest from the $900 million September sale of North Slope oil leases. I don't know if those figures are right, but they're mighty impressive to me. And the long-term prospects for continued revenues from future oil leasing and from royalties from production on a large scale are extremely bright from everything I can find out on this matter. The implications of this are exciting, to say the least, and it is, of course, the primary reason why we are all gathered here for these seminars. From the point of view of environmental policy, which, as I have pointed out, has become of such major concern nationally, the state of Alaska is in an extremely enviable position. For years, people have been saying that Alaska had a golden opportunity to learn from the mistakes of the past and from the mistakes in other states and so forth in developing its land and resource policies. And to an extent, the state has charted some new and significant courses in this direction in the political arena. But until this year, the economic constraint was such a controlling and limiting factor that the state was never able to rise to the challenge of shaping new approaches to environmental policies adjusted both to nature and to man's needs and values in this modern world of ours. So we find that these two major constraints, political and economic, have now been removed for all practical purposes. The basic question before you is, how should Alaska respond to this newfound freedom? There's probably no opportunity like it anywhere in this troubled world, and certainly the world will be watching. That an altogether new ecological approach to development is not only desirable but necessary is perhaps best illustrated by the Puerto Rican experience in its Operation Bootstraps program, which is often held up as the epitome of successful planning aimed at raising the standard of living. The island, as you know, started in the early 1940s on its path of economic development from scratch, and with a government and planning organization which could do virtually anything within the obvious outer limits. The planners and decision makers faced what seemed to them a relatively homogeneous, single focus economic problem. They so attacked it, and as a result, grossly oversimplified it. This has been brought out very clearly in a recent book by a professor of law at the University of Puerto Rico, Dr. Paro Maida. According to Dr. Maida, there are no questions concerning the actual growth of the Puerto Rican gross domestic product and its favorable material consequences. But the process has been one-sided economically, as he says, and uncontrolled ecologically, and too rapid socially. Some of the things he points out that went astray as a result of this narrow focus are uncontrolled city congestion and sprawl, a one-sided emphasis on industrialization, which resulted in an unnecessary decline in agriculture and the countryside, maldistribution of the multiplied national income, which created severe social problems, including an exponential growth of criminality, manifest deterioration of the human environment and of vital living conditions, even for those who are better off financially, and finally, rapidly growing environmental pollution, not only in the physical sense, but also culturally and aesthetically, under the onslaught, as he says, of uncontrolled commercialism, decrease in personal and property security, and in the sources of psychological repose. Maida analyzes all of these aspects that I just listed in some detail, and he concluded that as a result, Puerto Rico today is faced, after less than a generation, with a serious question of whether the community has progressed as a body and as a culture, or only as an object of production and income statistics. And the next question, he says, is whether the social and ecological price paid even for the quantitative material progress has not been intolerably high. His final statement is that the preponderance of evidence indicates that the environment and resource situation in Puerto Rico today is not only comparable to, but more serious than the economic situation was 25 years ago. Even the principal architect of Puerto Rico's prosperity, former Governor Luis Muñoz Marin, confessed in 1967 that the eternal platonic idea of a good life for the whole community was lost in the exclusive materialistic and economic pursuits. The economy, a servant turned master, could not be guided by such public relations slogans as Operations Bootstraps or Operation Serenity or the closest to paradise man has ever come. Moreover, the costs of doing business in Puerto Rico has increased greatly as a result of this environmental mismanagement. MEDA lays out in some detail the problems confronting the Puerto Rican government in the years ahead as a result of this emphasis on purely economic goals. He calls for a complete reevaluation of the planning approach based on the concept that I think he must have coined himself, the concept of eco-management, which in simplified terms is a way of exploring all of the consequences of an act, both good and bad, before it is actually tried. It's impossible for me to go into details about this study and his proposal, the specifics of his proposal this evening, but I would recommend it very highly to you, and I'll be happy to give any of you the full source on it later if you're interested. One of the problems, of course, is that too many people have the working philosophy that it can't happen here, and that only what is easy to do is necessary to do. It's true that environmental deterioration has not progressed here in Alaska to the stage that it has in many parts of this country, which now require massive, costly, long-term programs to rebuild and repair the mistakes of the past. And this is precisely the reason why the challenge of Alaska's future is so exciting. But there is absolutely no reason whatsoever for an attitude of complacency in Alaska. As almost any casual observer visiting the state can testify, the evidence of man-made environmental deterioration is freely visible nearly everywhere man has set foot. In addition, the state is now confronted with a series of crucial environmental policy issues emanating from the great oil discoveries in Arctic Alaska, which demand more careful consideration to minimize adverse effects on the delicate balance of the Arctic ecosystems. Nor is this all. In a recent paper entitled Geographical Engineering in the North, Dr. Don C. Foote, whom many of you probably knew before he died last spring, Don Foote, a human ecologist with long experience in the Arctic, listed and described some 32 different concrete proposals for large-scale engineering projects scattered throughout the North Polar region, not only, of course, in Alaska, but in Canada, the Soviet Union, and around the whole polar region. Some of these projects that he described would modify relatively small portions of the total northern environment, but would tend, if they were all built, of course, to have a cumulative effect, while others would bring in a single stroke vast environmental changes influencing the entire North Polar region. There are proposals, for example, to explode hydrogen bombs to melt the Arctic ice, or to spread a thin layer of coal and sand on the ice to speed melting and thus presumably open the Arctic basin to balmy winds and year-round shipping. Another proposal is to inject aerosols into the stratosphere from aircraft to accomplish the same purpose by creating a greenhouse effect over the entire Arctic basin. There are numerous proposals to excavate harbors and dig canals by nuclear explosives, and to use these nuclear devices also to retrieve oil from extensive areas of oil shales and tar sands located throughout the Arctic region. Others propose to solve the water shortage of the more southerly regions of the United States by diverting and reversing the great northward flowing Arctic rivers. This would require geographical engineering on a massive scale, involving the construction, of course, of huge dams, a lengthy and complex system of canals, and appropriately located storage facilities and pumping stations capable of manipulating and controlling water on a continental basis. One of the most impressive of these transfer schemes from an engineering standpoint, as most of you I'm sure are aware, is the so-called NAWAPA plan, the North American Water and Power Alliance, which would divert water from the Yukon and other northern watersheds southward through Canada to the United States, where it would flow through a series of canals eastward to the Great Lakes and southward to the dry Rocky Mountain and southwest regions, and finally on into Mexico. Proposed water diversions in Siberia have been equally large, involving dams on the upper Yenisei and Ob rivers with canals to the eastward. As Don Foote pointed out in his paper, regardless of how far-fetched some of these ideas may seem, they all are technically feasible and are being actively promoted by various protagonists seeking to solve specific problems by engineering methods, but invariably with little or no understanding of the long-term ecological implications. And he concluded that the North Star region is entering a historical phase which, in terms of human impact, will probably be its last. Whether these new technological powers will take us in this direction that is intimated by all of these projects that are proposed remains to be seen, but there is no doubt that we now possess the abilities to manipulate and shape the natural and the human environment in ways never conceived of only a few years ago. Whereas in the rest of the United States, gradualism has sort of masked the full environmental costs of material abundance, in Alaska there has been and will be a sudden confrontation. What was yesterday a desolate stretch of tundra is today the cap of a multi-billion barrel oil field. A pipeline from Prudhoe Bay across the breadth of the state to Valdez seemed yesterday to be impossible. Now it's almost a reality, getting close. Today it's, this is one of the largest single enterprises I understand ever attempted anywhere, and under physical conditions totally unlike those previously experienced anywhere on the globe. What seemed yesterday to be an almost continuous stretch of Arctic wilderness with no foreseeable prospects for intrusion is today a region man is preparing to open up and develop, or just as soon as the land freeze is lifted. Oil developments, mining, transportation corridors into the interior, land purchases and subdivisions, settlements, airports, whole new cities on the tundra, huge tankers in the Arctic to link Alaska with the great world markets. Overnight, a whole new vision has developed of the North. And as one developer was quick to recognize, Alaska is no longer Seward's folly, but Seward's success. It is difficult to believe that the scale and pace of this projected development is beyond our direction and control. We can each foresee a range of alternative futures for Alaska, and these may differ significantly, but all of us together, I think, can agree that 10 years from now, we want to be able to find Alaska a better place. The question is, how do we agree on what a better place is? What direction all this will take in Alaska and in the North generally depends heavily, of course, upon human motives, their desires, and the values that take hold now and in the very immediate future. If you follow the same old, time-worn paths of the past, with the one-sided emphasis on narrow economic goals, the picture here in a few years will probably be even more bleaker than that painted by Professor Maida of the Puerto Rican situation, for many of the mistakes here undoubtedly will produce irreparable ecological damage. Three things are required, it seems to me, if you are to avoid this fate. First, of course, is the will to act in a responsible fashion toward the environment. Without this, naturally, there is little hope. Second is the need for much more precise scientific and ecological knowledge upon which to base policy decisions that will influence the character and quality of the environment. Such knowledge has always been a scarce resource in Alaska, although it may be true, as some people have pointed out, that more dollars per capita are spent on research in Alaska than in any other state, we still remain woefully ignorant about this northern environment. The massive oil discovery on the North Slope is an event that has dramatized and highlighted this ignorance in a way that would have been impossible through the publication of a number of reports. Means must be found to launch the kind of research programs that will provide concrete guidelines and answers for those charged with making crucial environmental policy decisions at the federal, state, and local levels of government. Third, new governmental institutions must be developed, especially at the state level, which have both the authority and the resources to implement an environmental policy for Alaska. Devising these new institutions will not be easy. Not only are the organizational problems complex, but there are few models to turn to for guidance. Since I plan to discuss possible alternative institutional arrangements in my presentation tomorrow morning, I'll not go into detail here now. However, to support the basic point that I'm trying to make here, I would like to refer to a concluding statement at a congressional conference on the environment held in Washington, D.C. last month, in which members of Congress, scientists, and technologists discussed the environmental crisis facing this nation and possible avenues of solution. It was pointed out there that if the elected representatives in Congress and the state legislatures fail to respond to the public demand for a healthy environment, then the democratic process was not working and a revolution, either gradual or violent, was inevitable. For anyone who has followed the situation very closely in the United States, there is no doubt that the public is much more concerned now about protection of the environment than in any other time in our history, and governments at all levels have been much too slow in responding to this. Incidentally, I think it's interesting and maybe significant to note that the chairman of that congressional conference that I just quoted from was a prominent Alaskan himself, former Senator Ernest Greening. Recently, the governor of California launched a major statewide program for a clean environment with the charge that if we can make it work here, You'd be surprised how fast what we do will be followed throughout the United States. I agree, but I don't think California has much chance. The destruction has gone so far. But I am firmly convinced that Alaska is in a much superior political and economic and physical position to take leadership among the states and environmental administration, but only if its political and business leaders grasp the nature and extent of this challenge. In this connection, one final point I think needs to be mentioned. There are some 200 million Americans who still own around 90% of Alaska, and they aren't likely to remain calmly on the sidelines if Alaskans don't measure up to this responsibility. It's not my intention at all to state this as a threat from an outsider. Having lived in Alaska for a long time, I know how that rankles. But merely to point out the political realities of the situation, a revolution is going on in this country. There are some who proclaim that only those living in Alaska who know it personally have any valid claim to a voice in its future. Well, this is sheer political rhetoric aimed at obscuring reality by the manipulation of political symbols. The evidence at hand, as we can see, is that the national interest in the future of Alaska is extremely strong. The Secretary of the Interior himself has refused to allow a private interest to reshape a significant portion of Alaska's environment, and therefore of Alaska's future, without first giving careful consideration to the effects of their proposal on the national interest. Here is one clear sign which suggests the folly of ignoring Alaska's political ecology in any attempt to act wisely in relationship to its natural ecology. As a matter of priority, both the federal and state governments must put their own environmental policy houses in order. If either fails, the other cannot do its job properly, and environmental chaos will surely be the result. If we cannot do this here in Alaska, I fear for the future of this whole nation. I hope these remarks this evening will help to place the central issue of this seminar in its proper perspective. Thank you.